Tax Update for Saturday, May 26, 2007. This is Tax Update for Saturday, May 26, 2007. This week, on second try, the tax law changes come back after a veto. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. Podcast and the document are may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio podcast. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners who have subscribed to their services. You can visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Well, just yesterday, the Congress passed, and the President claims he is going to sign, the first tax bill of the new Congress, at least the first significant tax bill. And that tax bill, which is linked with the minimum wage increase, was also linked with the funding for the Iraqi Defense Department appropriation, was vetoed on the first pass, dealing with a withdrawal date from Iraq. The President was apparently not overly concerned with the tax provisions because we have them back virtually unchanged. And the tax provisions give us both good news and bad news for your clients. The purpose of the tax provisions was to give breaks to small businesses that it was felt may be negatively impacted by the increase in minimum wage. However, Congress sought to pay for any tax increase with revenue raisers elsewhere, so we'll have to look both at the good news and the bad news of this bill. That is, what Congress giveth, Congress taketh away, and we're going to find that some of your clients will be winners and some will be losers under the new provisions. But we'll look at both. Now, this is not a comprehensive look at the bill because the bill has a lot of provisions, and I'm not going to go into some of the provisions, but we're going to try to hit some of the highlights in the tax arena that we need to be looking at for this new bill. Well, let's start with the good news, since we always like to start with good news, and we are entering into the Memorial Day weekend, so let's start on the upbeat deal and then go to the downbeat toward the end. So we'll take a look at the good news in the areas where Congress has decreased the tax burden on at least some of your clients. The first issue, and the one that maybe probably gets the most coverage initially because it could potentially affect the most clients, is the increase in Section 179 expensing. And I should say could impact clients. Realistically, most of my clients I've discovered in the businesses I work with either were below the 100,000 limit to begin with or 100,000 plus now, or have so much in equipment purchases they never got the 179 anyway. Nevertheless, we do have some changes to 179 that will work to help some clients. First, immediately and effective for 2006, the expensing limitation for Section 179 will now be set at $125,000. Now, that provision will stay in place through 2010. That's 1 year longer than it was scheduled to be in place under the current law with the increases that we got earlier. So we're looking at an additional year. As well, the phase-out level increases to $500,000, and again, both the $125,000 and the $500,000 will be indexed for inflation. So basically, we're going to be getting an index level of $179,000. This also is an increase that is essentially effective for this year. So we get it for years ending after December 31st, 2006. Now, as a side note, for Arizona practitioners, those of you who are here in Arizona, like myself, are all pretty much aware that one of the key areas Arizona does not conform to is Section 179 expensing. We're still stuck with the old $25,000 limit. You need to point out that mechanically, with the way the Arizona statutes are structured and what Congress is doing here, even if the legislature rolls through and does their standard conformity bill next January, that conformity bill would not change the $25,000 limitation. In essence, Arizona non-conforms and just says ignore, add back any 179 in excess of 25. So unless they change the statute more than simply roll the date forward, Arizona would not conform to this increase either. And that's true even if we get a what would normally be referred to as a true conformity bill next January. Another positive for taxpayers, at least if you have taxpayers in the restaurant business, is what's effectively an increase, or let's say prevention of a decrease, in the FICA tip credit. Now, if you don't have restaurant clients, this may be a little confusing, but we'll kind of work through it. Basically, restaurants are allowed to pay essentially wages below the minimum wage level, and the theory being that the tips make up for it. So if the tips make up for the difference between the minimum wage and what they are paying, and it is subject to a different floor, they can't go all the way down to zero, but subject to a lower minimum wage floor, if the tips make up, then the restaurant can pay out of their basically coffers a lower amount for wages to the employees. However, they're still liable for the FICA on the tips. Now, restaurants do get a tax credit for any tips they pay FICA on that are in excess of the amount of the minimum wage. So if an employee collects, which we would presume they will if we're trying to make up the difference, let's say employee has wages, has tips that push them over the minimum wage, then the employer gets a credit for those tips that they're for the FICA on the tips that are paid. Well, now with the increase in the minimum wage, if nothing else was done, that credit would go down even if, you know, nothing else changed on the employer's side. Well, what Congress has done is for restaurants, they have kicked this in so that for restaurants, we'll still look to the old minimum wage in effect on January 1st, 2007 for purposes of computing this credit. As well, for purposes of this credit, we're going to be able to offset this credit against the alternative minimum tax liability. This credit and the work opportunity tax credit, and by the way, that credit, we won't go through in detail here, but it has been expanded and extended. Both of these credits will now be available to offset against the taxpayer's alternative minimum tax liability. So taxpayers will be able to take these credits in that regard. These, again, are supposed to help offset some of the costs of the increase in the minimum wage. Now, the bill addresses kind of an interesting thing. In the middle of these breaks, there is this fix in the bill that's meant to address what is a problem that you might have in a state that's not a community property state. There's a differential. And this has to go back to explaining a revenue procedure and some issues that have arisen under limited liability companies and the IRS's attempt to deal with single-member limited liability companies, and now their attempts to deal with their attempt to deal with that. And this is how Congress comes in and fixes it. But what we had was effectively a quirk in the tax law. Now let's think about LLCs. A limited liability company that has an interest that is owned by the taxpayer, let's say, or has a single member LLC. But in a community property state, that interest in most cases by default would end up being community property of the spouses. Well, now that's a potential problem because the definition of a partnership under the code, if we look to the code section 7701 and then we look to the regulation 77301, 7701-2C1, it provides the term partnership means a business entity that is not a corporation and has at least two members. Well, I have husband and wife that own the LLC interest. That looked like a partnership. Because of confusion that arose over whether one could have a single member LLC in a community property state or not, the IRS issued Revenue Procedure 2002-69. Now, that procedure allowed a qualified entity, which will now have a new type of qualified something in the code, but this was a qualified entity, to file either as a disregarded entity, treated as if it had a single owner, or a partnership if it met the following criteria. Those criteria was the business has to be owned wholly by husband and wife as community properties under the laws of a state, a foreign country, or possession of the United States. No person other than one or both spouses would be considered an owner for federal tax purposes, and the business entity is not treated as a corporation. If all three of those were met, then the entity under Revenue Procedure 2002-69 could elect to file either as a disregarded entity, basically ignore it, put it on the tax return, or it on the 1040, or it could file as a partnership, file the 1065 report on the K-1. Well, that's fine and solve the issue, so now we can have a disregarded entity in a community property state. But now those individuals that lived in non-community property states and maybe had their interest in their LLC held as joint tenancy by the two spouses saying, well, wait a second, where does that put us? You know, where are we standing now? You know, do we have to file a partnership return? Well, it would appear technically following the law, the answer there was yes, because Revenue Procedure 2002-69, interestingly enough, as we noted, required the property be held as community property. So it appeared that any other holding of the property would create a situation where a partnership return arguably was required. Congress has now moved to address this. The bill creates a new type of entity that's called a qualified joint venture, and it meets the following criteria. The only members of the joint venture are a husband and wife. Second, both spouses materially participate in the trade or business as defined under Section 469H, which is the active participation provisions of the passive activity rules, with the exception that you don't get to say that my spouse is actively participating, so I get actively participate. That is an option under 469H that is specifically eliminated as a way of proving active participation here. Kind of makes sense. Otherwise, it'd be ridiculous. You just say one of them participated. And both spouses elect to treat the entity as a qualified joint venture. If all three of those are handled, then we report this as essentially two Schedule Cs. Oh yeah, it deals with the concept we've seen on 1040s before, where individuals file tax returns as, quote, joint Schedule Cs, where they reported husband and wife on a Schedule C and split the income. Well, we've seen that done, but arguably there was no support for doing that under the law, except that quite often the IRS didn't seem to care, and in fact there were even tax court cases where obviously that's what was done and nobody seems to have objected. But certainly under the regulations that didn't appear to be proper, it appeared to be a partnership. Now under this code provision, we will be able to file that kind of joint Schedule C, although actually if you read the committee reports, you do not file a joint Schedule C. Rather, you file two Schedule Cs and you split the income based upon their ownership ratios in this entity. And that will be true for both income tax and self-employment tax purposes, so there'll be a joint Schedule C done. Now, this provision will be effective for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2006. So the 2007 tax year we're in now, your spouses will be able to choose. If we have a business in which both spouses participate, it's a qualified joint venture, we can then elect to treat it and report it on the Schedule C. Now, the IRS will most likely, I would presume, come up with some guidance, but we would presume if you had something that had previously been reporting as a partnership, we would presume the IRS guidance will be similar to what we saw in 2002-69, which tells us, you know, essentially to treat it as if you transfer from the partnership to the non-partnership entity, you would treat it as essentially, you know, the termination of the partnership with all of the events that would go on through that. But that would, I presume, be the guidance for right now, though we don't have guidance on how you'll handle it, but at least it appears that you could convert such a partnership now into a set, basically a proprietorship, and report that on the Schedule C beginning this year. The next thing they did, there are a couple of issues that deal with S corporations. We'll touch on a couple of them. There are additional provisions that deal with bank S corporations and deduction of interest for certain S corporation trusts. We're not going to worry about that. What I'm going to look at here is a couple of S corporation provisions that are somewhat interesting. First, Act Section 8231 provides that no longer shall we treat gains on the sale of stock or security as passive income for S corporation purposes. Now, realize when I say passive income here, I'm not having anything to do with Section 469. We're talking about Section 1362D3 entirely, which, to add to the confusion Congress loves to add, is a totally different passive income concept from the passive income under 469. But under 1362D3, if you have an S corporation that has earnings and profits, generally means it was previously a C corporation, and if that corporation has excess passive income, two bad things can happen. First bad thing that can happen, there will be an entity-level tax imposed. Well, that's bad enough. The second bad thing, though, is that if this happens 3 years in a row where we have excess passive income, the S corporation election is terminated at the end of that third year. Just terminated, gone, done. You are no longer an S corporation. That can be a real problem. Now, normally what we had to do to get around that, if that was going to be an issue, is we turned around and paid out all the earnings and profits, took our distribution and elected to treat them as coming first out of E&P to eliminate the earnings and profits, which eliminated the problem. However, that's a rather expensive solution in many cases. largely because by doing that, we end up having to push out all the E&P, pay the dividend. If there was significant earnings and profits, that's a problem. This law honestly was put on the books primarily to avoid somebody from trying to escape, basically take a C corporation, switch it over to S, then liquidate it, have a difference in beginning basis, and like keep the stocks and securities inside the S corporation and just keep operating it forever, you know, having investment income coming out. This was meant to force that entity to actually get swapped back to C, so you couldn't use the S corporation to try to keep from hitting that second level individual tax unless you were willing to take all the earnings and profits out. Well, Congress now has changed this rule. And now, one interesting aside is no longer will transactions related to capital gains on the sale of stock and securities will no longer count toward the excess passive income rule. Now, there is one important thing to remember about this rule. The effective date of this law is for taxable years, of this provision, is for taxable years beginning after the date of enactment, which will be the date the president signs the bill. The practical effect, since we're almost always dealing with calendar year S corporations, is it won't be effective for 2007. So if this is year three and you're going to lose your status, the capital gains will still count against you. However, next year in 2008, you will be able to ignore any capital gains. That may affect your investment procedures in a corporation like this. It may cause you some other issues to consider. But do realize that this will take effect in 2008, not 2007. So if you have an issue, that issue will still arise if they have capital gains incurred this year. Now, the next section involved was kind of a fix to a quirk in the treatment of Q-subs. And especially if an S-corporation with a qualified S-corporation subsidiary sold shares in that S-corporation subsidiary, so the entity was no longer a qualified S-corporation subsidiary and couldn't be treated that way. Well, the Treasury regulations, as described in the Joint Committee's report, an explanation on this bill, held currently that in that situation, they gave an example where the S-corporation sold 21% of its shares to a third unrelated third party. Well, under the regulations, what we have, of course, is we've now gone from what was effectively a disregarded entity, not really, but close enough, something awfully close to an LLC, disregarded entity. We suddenly converted that over to a C corporation. We lost our S election. We became basically, converted over to a C because we're now a corporation with a corporate shareholder. Well, now we have to consider what happens. What happens now, since we no longer have a Q sub, is we have a deemed incorporation. So we pretend, just like with the LLCs, we pretend. We pretend we have incorporated. Well, as Treasury points out, we pretend looking at the law, at the transaction, as if it occurred outside the corporate setting. And if you look at it that way, the Treasury said, well, what we really had here was the sale of 21% of the assets to an outside third party. And the incorporation then by the contribution of the property to the S Corp, followed by the sale of the shares. So the cooperation, we basically contribute to this new corp that will become a C Corp, all of the assets, and then we immediately sell off the 21% interest. Well, since the step transaction doctrine would apply to a Section 351 transaction in that case, what we really end up with is we have a corporation we're not in control of after the contribution. Therefore, since our interest is only 79%, we now have to recognize gain on the contribution of 100% of the assets. Not just on the 21% interest we sold, but we're going to recognize the whole thing going into that new corporation. The law changes that effect. Under the new law, the transaction is going to be treated in the following manner, presuming no other tax-free transaction provision would have applied to the transaction in question. We're going to treat as if the parent S corporation is deemed to sell an undivided interest in all assets of the subsidiary for the amount of the purchase price of the stock. So now, in exchange for the dollars we're going to get for the subsidiary stock, we're going to treat that as if we sold to the buyer an undivided interest in all the assets. Then the buyer and the old owner, the S corporation, old owner, then contribute those assets to the new corporation under Section 351. In that case, they have 100% control contributing the assets, and because of that, Section 351 rules, standard rules, would apply. Now, the provision does indicate that it's not intended to basically invalidate any other transaction. Therefore, if another tax-free provision would have applied in this case, we go ahead and we can treat under that provision rather than having to treat it under 351. But this will be the rule to get around that this provision applies to taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2006. So that's the new treatment for CUSIP. We finished that. Let's go to the bad news. We've got to pay for the above. Well, the first piece of bad news, the kiddie tax is extended yet again. Just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, right? We've extended all through the time period the kids are minors, right? All the way they turn 18, the age of majority, the kiddie tax ends. How can Congress extend that? In fact, my partner said such last year when that passed. Well, you know, they're taking this as far as they can take it because now, you know, they're age majority, and it certainly wouldn't be fair to tax them after that on mom and dad's income. Well, unfortunately, the Congress didn't agree with my partner, and it turns out the Congress has now decided that we can tax them beyond that point. So now, automatically, two changes are made. First, the age that you get out of the kiddie tax is bumped by a year for everybody. So the child turns 18 for the year the child is 18. They're still going to be subject to the kiddie tax. So they have to be over age 18 before they get out of it. But secondly, even if the child is past age 18, so they're over age 18, under age 24. So basically, under age 24, over age 18, they will be subject to the kiddie tax if they are a full-time student, and their earned income for the tax, basically the income for the taxable year does not exceed one half of the child support for the year. Now that's nasty. It's obviously aimed at the students and aimed at the old deal where we invested the funds to pay for the child's education. That's not going to work anymore, essentially, because we've set this up where if they have over half their support, they don't provide over half their own support from earned income. Which, by the way, if they're providing over half their support, we can't take them as a dependent, right? Remember that one? They're not providing over half their support from earned income. Notice even if they are providing over half their support, it's still only going to work if that income is not earned. We basically have to tax them at mom and dad's rates. That also impacts the planning many were thinking of doing for the 0% capital gain rate that we're coming up on. Well, that isn't going to work either now, because it doesn't matter if there's a 0% low capital gain rate, because if the kid sells it, we're still going to be at mom and dad's capital gain rate. This probably increases the attractiveness of vehicles such as 529 plan and Coverdell IRA for education savings vehicles for taxpayers, you know, where you suspect the kiddie tax will be a problem, mom and dad's income is relatively high. The only good news we really have is that this change is effective for years beginning after the date of enactment. So 2007 will still be taxed under the old rules. 2008, we will have the new kiddie tax rules in play. Now, the next revenue raiser took place and basically took back something that the Congress had given us in back in the old IRS restructuring days. Remember the IRS reform days, late 90s, we were going to get the kinder, gentler IRS. Well, now Congress has decided maybe they overdid it there and they're going to take back. One of the key provisions that was added back then was that if the IRS did not assess a taxpayer within 18 months after the date the return was filed, that interest and penalties largely stopped running. And they stopped running until 21 days after the date on which the IRS actually assessed the tax and gave an explanation to the taxpayer of the liability. That rule is going to be changed now. We are going to go from 18 months to 36 months. By the way, you may notice coincidentally that's 3 years of the normal statute. So the interest and penalties will not stop running unless the IRS does not get their assessment and explanation out within 3 years. Otherwise, the interest and penalties will continue to run. That essentially guts this provision in many ways, because unless we get to an extension of the statute, basically IRS assessments will continue to contain all the interest and penalties. They will have the full 3 years to get the assessment done and get the full interest and penalties applied. The next step, the IRS, the Congress decided as another method of going back, one of the other key things was added in that act was a lot of collection due process options. Congress has decided maybe that went too far. They're going to remove the right of a taxpayer to request a collection due process hearing prior to the issuance of a levy on an employment tax matter if the taxpayer had previously requested a collection due process hearing with regard to unpaid employment taxes arising in the 2-year period prior to the beginning of the period for which the current levy is served. Rather, that taxpayer is only going to be given a right to contest the levy with a hearing after it has been issued. So it'll be an after-the-fact request, not a before-the-fact. It won't suspend the levy. The provision will be effective for levies issued 120 days after the date of enactment of the bill. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention on the 36-month interest rule that we talked about earlier. Therefore, that rule comes into play for the IRS for notices issued 6 months after the effective date, after the enactment date of the bill. Now, it's kind of interesting in both of these cases, the IRS might be better off delaying doing certain things so they get the longer period or different set of rules by waiting until after these become effective to do their move. Now, another kind of oddball issue, little one that was thrown in, as if not surprising to anyone, I don't think anyone believed they weren't permanent, but just in case you thought for some reason that user fees really were going to go away at September 30, 2014, this act makes user fees permanent for things like letter rulings, determination letters, opinion letters, similar items. There will now be permanent. Previously, the IRS's authority to get user fees for those items were set to expire on September 30, 2014. Again, I don't think any of us seriously thought that that authority would actually go away, but now we know it has been formally extended. The law expands the scope of and increases the preparer penalties for understatement of the taxpayer's liability. Under current law, there was a 2-tier penalty on income tax preparers that dealt with underpayments that were reported on their clients' tax returns. Under the old law, if a preparer basically was found to have an undisclosed position on the return for which it was not a realistic possibility of the position being sustained on its merits, or which was frivolous, a penalty of $250 could be imposed by the IRS. If the preparer engaged in willful or reckless conduct, the penalty went up to $1,000 on the preparer. What happens under this bill is we expand the reach of the penalty, so now it applies to basically any type of tax filing, estate and gift taxes, employment taxes, excise tax filings, and the penalty itself is increased into a two-tier, into a basically two tests. The penalty for the first tier, that was the lack of realistic possibility, undisclosed position, is raised to the greater of $1,000 or 50% of the income to be derived by the preparer from the preparation of the return, either the income they did derive or the income they would have derived from the preparation of the return. So essentially, if you were going to charge a fee of $2,000 for the return, even if you weren't paid, the 50% would be $1,000. Well, you'd be at the maximum penalty. If you're going to charge a fee of $5,000, your penalty would be $2,500, even if none of it had been paid. But if you charge $10, your penalty would still be $1,000, because that is the penalty for failing to disclose the realistic possibility on the return. Now, commentators have quite often pointed out the differential between this rule and the penalty on a preparer and the rule for the taxpayer and penalties, and that this puts some friction between the taxpayer and the preparer. That friction will no doubt increase somewhat based upon these new higher penalties, especially if, as you might suspect, the IRS is looking to get these in order to increase enforcement against preparers because they've been doing a lot of saber rattling in that area. Now, the second-tier penalty, which is imposed on a preparer who engages in willful or reckless conduct, is now raised to the greater of $5,000, or 50% of the income derived or to be derived by the preparer. Previously, that penalty had been set at $1,000. So this penalty, again, $5,000. Again, if you had charged $50 to do the return, but you engaged in willful or reckless conduct to understate the taxpayer's liability, $5,000 is the penalty. It will go higher if your fee was higher than that, was higher than $10,000. Now, the Act imposes a new penalty for filing erroneous refund claims. And essentially, this penalty is 20% of any disallowed refund claim is imposed as a penalty unless the taxpayer can show there was a reasonable basis for the claim tax treatment. Now, clearly, what Congress is after here, I think they're after solving a problem, and actually the IRS is themselves. The IRS has unfortunately become notorious for paying out refund claims without really paying attention to what they are. A number of frivolous claims have been paid multiple times. The IRS, despite the fact that these things have been around forever, still rarely ends up issuing refund claims to people on tax protester arguments or the slavery reparation deal, and then comes back later and has to collect those. Well, what the IRS will now be able to do is charge a 20% penalty if it's disallowed, unless there was a reasonable basis. So it's not the case of playing the lottery to get those payments or putting a claim in and seeing what happens. Now, the hitch is this provision, though, is written just openly the way the law is written. It reads that there is a 20% penalty imposed on a disallowed claim, period, and it is only taken away if you can show reasonable cause. That could have an impact on certain claims for refund if there's no reasonable basis for the position presented. It might also, until we get some guidance, present some issues when you try to do a protective claim, the statute is running out, and you don't know for sure what the claim will be, so you traditionally would have claimed the maximum possible and then worked your way back down. Now the question will be, did you have a reasonable basis to make that claim, so when it gets knocked back down, do you lose and do you have to pay in 20% of the amount it gets knocked down? Interesting question. We'll see what kind of guidance the IRS offers in those situations. But that is the new penalty for filing an erroneous refund claim. And then to prove some things never change, Congress has hit problems over the years of they need to fudge bills, they need to fudge and move some money around because they want to have money in one fiscal year and not another. Congress has found a favorite way to play that game is to play with estimated tax payments, and recently corporate estimates have been a really fun place for them to play. Well, it turns out Congress needed to fudge a bit on this bill. And the way it works is corporations with assets of at least $1 billion were going to be required to pay 106.25% of the tax amount otherwise due for their estimates due in July, August, and September 2012, and then reduce the next estimate basically by that extra 6.25% they had paid. So we got it shoved in. Now, not coincidentally, that's the estimate payment due just before the government's fiscal year ends. The following one is in the next fiscal year. So they were taking from the fiscal year that would end in September of 2013 and moving the funds into the year ending September 2012, since the IRS, or I should say not the IRS, but the federal government operates on a cash basis. Now it turns out we need a little bit more in that 2012 year. So they have raised the percentage in that year to 114.25% for those payments due in July, August, and September. So if you deal with a large corporation, you're a large corporate, you're in the tax department of a large corporation, just make a note on your calendar that the extra estimate payment just got bumped for that year. So keep a note on that. When that payment comes up, get ready for it. Now note, there's other things in this bill. The bill contains provisions we aren't going to discuss, including technical corrections and a little correction beyond technical correction for pension bill from the Pension Protection Act of 2006 and other pension items, and extension of various GO tax incentives that are related to the Katrina area. Both of those are in this bill. There are a few other S corporation provisions involved and a few other items in the bill. Oh, and by the way, of course, an increase in minimum wage level that your clients may be interested in. But this is the first bill we've seen out of this Congress, so this is our first tax bill of the season, so get ready. We may see more coming down the line. This is early in the year for Congress to start tax bills, so maybe we'll see others come at us later on. Now, this has been the tax update for May the 26th, 2007. This tax update is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Visit them to find information that is of interest to tax practitioners. I would note that they have the Joint Committee's report on this bill, so if you're a subscriber to Limeburg Services, you may want to go to their actual text column and get a look at the details in the committee report for more details on this bill. This has been the Tax Update.